Hello, this is Ed Reedy from the Talking Information Center with today's reading from Reuters. Supreme Court backs Trump's FTC firing, expands presidential power by John Krizel. Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday backed Donald Trump's firing of a Democratic Federal Trade Commission member, expanding his powers over the government and overturning its 1935 precedent that had recognized the authority of Congress to protect leaders of certain regulatory agencies from presidential removal at will. The justices, in a 6-3 decision powered by the court's conservative majority, invalidated tenure protections for FTC members enacted by Congress more than a century ago. In doing so, the justices overruled the court's pivotal decision in a case called Humphrey's Executor versus United States. Trump last year dismissed the FTC's Rebecca Slaughter over policy differences. The court, however, signaled that the decision should not be seen as undermining the Federal Reserve's independence, with the justices describing the U.S. Central Bank as possessing a unique historical tradition. In another landmark ruling on Monday, the court refused to let Trump fire Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook, standing firm to preserve central bank independence. In the FTC case, the court ruled that removal protections for FTC members unlawfully encroached on presidential power under the U.S. Constitution. The very essence, Chief Justice John Roberts, who authored the decision, joined by his five fellow conservatives, said Trump's authority to dismiss Slaughter last year over policy differences is not a close case. The court's three liberal justices dissented. The FTC's for cause removal provision violates the separation of powers, Roberts wrote, referring to the constitutional language dividing up the authority of the government's three branches. In its present form, the FTC enforces and administers some 80 statutes, which cover almost every facet of our nation's economy. The tasks it undertakes are the very essence of execution of the law, precisely the president's constitutional role. Subordinates who exercise the president's power are subject to removal by him, Roberts added. Slaughter, appointed to her post by Democratic former President Joe Biden, was one of two Democratic FTC commissioners who Trump moved to fire in March of 2025 from the Consumer Protection and Antitrust Agency. Slaughter's term was due to run until 2029. A 1914 law passed by Congress permitted a president to remove FTC commissioners only for cause, such as inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office, but not for policy differences. Similar protections cover officials at more than two dozen other independent agencies, including the National Labor Relations Board and Merit Systems Protection Board. It was not immediately clear whether the independence of these other agencies would be stripped under Monday's ruling. While the court's majority said its decision should not be read as determining the fate of officials other than Slaughter, the liberal justices in a dissent said the ruling gives the president a power unknown even to the English crown against which the founders revolted. Put simply, today the majority reshapes our government. Dozens of independent commissions are now likely to become purely executive agencies, shifting tremendous power over broad swaths of American life into the president's hands, wrote Justice Sonia Sotomayor, joined by fellow liberal justices Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson. Trump hails big win. On social media, Trump welcomed the Slaughter ruling as a big win. Trump said the decision was confirming presidential power in our country to remove executive branch officers and agency appointees or representatives under Article II, the constitutional provision laying out presidential powers. The decision was long sought by United States presidents dating all the way back to the 1930s. Trump wrote, calling the decision one of the most important ever given with respect to presidential powers. Slaughter said she was disappointed with the ruling and shocked when the court overturns a unanimous 91-year-old precedent that has been used to shape so much of our government institutions. I think why it really matters is exactly as President Trump said. It is unprecedented, Slaughter said on CNBC, and it hands a massive amount of power away from Congress and to the president to shape economic decision-making in a way that will reward the rich and powerful and at the expense of ordinary Americans. Democratic senators and anti-monopoly groups voiced concern that Trump sought to eliminate the agency's scrutiny of big corporations. Washington-based U.S. District Judge Lauren Alican in July 2025 blocked Trump's firing of Slaughter, rejecting his administration's argument that the tenure protections unlawfully encroached on presidential power. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit the following month in a 2-1 decision kept Alican's rule in place. But the Supreme Court in September allowed Trump's ouster to Slaughter to take effect, an action that drew dissents from its 3 liberal justices while agreeing to hear arguments in the case. The lower courts ruled that the statutory protections shielded FTC members from removal without cause, complied with the Constitution in light of the Humphreys executor precedent. The court in Humphreys executor rebuffed Democratic President Franklin Roosevelt's attempt to fire an FTC member over policy differences despite tenure protections given by Congress. In the 1935 decision, the court said, restricting a president's removal of commissioners was lawful because the FTC performed tasks more closely resembling legislative and judicial functions rather than those belonging squarely to the executive branch headed by the president. The Trump administration argued that the modern FTC grew to wield substantial executive power in the decades since that decision, draining that ruling of its force. The arguments advanced by Justice Department lawyers representing Trump in the case embraced the unitary executive theory. This conservative legal doctrine sees the president as possessing sole authority over the executive branch, including the power to fire and replace heads of independent agencies at will, despite legal protections provided by Congress for these positions. The Constitution set up a separation of powers among the U.S. government co-equal executive, legislative, and judicial branches as part of a system of checks and balances. The Supreme Court in recent decades had narrowed the reach of Humphrey's executor, but stopped short of overturning it. The Slaughter case represented the latest instance of the Supreme Court overturning one of its major precedents. For instance, the court in 2022 overturned the 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling that had recognized a woman's constitutional right to have an abortion. And in 2024, it overturned a 1984 precedent that had given deference to government agencies in interpreting laws they administer. U.S. Supreme Court endorses grace periods for mail-in ballots by Andrew Chung. Washington. The U.S. Supreme Court backed on Monday state laws that allow mail-in ballots received after Election Day to be counted, rejecting a Republican-led challenge to a 5-day grace period in Mississippi and dealing a setback to President Donald Trump. The justices in a 5-4 ruling overturned a lower court's decision that had deemed Mississippi's law inconsistent with U.S. statutes that set the timing of federal elections for the presidency, Senate, and House of Representatives. Trump last year vowed to end the use of mail-in ballots nationwide before this November's midterm elections, when his fellow Republicans are seeking to retain control of Congress. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, in an opinion joined by fellow conservative Chief Justice John Roberts and the court's 3 liberals, wrote that federal law requires only that voters cast their ballot by Election Day. The Election Day statute says nothing about ballot receipt, and we cannot add to the words Congress chose, Barrett wrote. The ruling means Mississippi can continue to permit mail-in ballots to be counted if they were postmarked on or before Election Day, but received up to 5 business days after a federal election. Absentee voting by mail in Mississippi is limited to a few categories of voters, including people age 65 and above, the disabled, and those living away from home. About 30 states and the District of Columbia accept at least some ballots that are postmarked on or before Election Day, but received afterward. 4 other members of the court's 6-3 conservative majority dissented from Monday's ruling. Justice Samuel Alito, writing on their behalf, said the ruling creates a serious risk of further undermining public confidence in our elections and our system of self-government. Tremendous loss. The Republican National Committee, the Mississippi Republican Party, and other plaintiffs filed a lawsuit in 2024 seeking to invalidate Mississippi's law. Trump's administration backed the challenge. Restricting mail-in ballots would stand to disproportionately benefit Republicans, given that Democratic voters traditionally have been more likely to use mail-in ballots than Republican voters. After the ruling, Trump again called on Congress to pass the Save America Act, a partisan federal election bill that would require photo identification to vote and proof of citizenship to register to vote. Republicans have been unable to overcome Democratic opposition in the U.S. Senate, where 60 votes are required to advance most legislation in the 100-seat chamber. Republicans hold a 53-47 Senate majority. Democrats have accused Trump of pursuing measures that would make it harder for people to vote, especially groups that tend to favor Democratic candidates. In light of the tremendous loss in the Supreme Court today concerning voters' rights and the fact that people's votes are allowed to be counted long after an election is over, it's more important than ever to pass the Save America Act, Trump wrote. Trump added, "There's only one reason to oppose: cheating." Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer welcomed Monday's ruling. As the midterm elections approach, Trump and his allies are working overtime to silence Americans' votes. Senate Democrats will continue to do everything we can to protect free and fair elections where everyone's voice is heard, Schumer said. Rebecca Carruthers, president and CEO of the Fair Elections Center Voting Rights Group, said the ruling affirms a basic principle. Voters who follow the rules and mail their ballots on time should not lose their voice due to delays beyond their control. By upholding postmark rules, the court protects millions who rely on mail voting, in particular senior citizens, rural voters, people with disabilities, and military and overseas voters, Carruthers said. A skeptical view. Republicans have taken a skeptical view toward mail-in ballots. Trump has sought to cast doubt on the security of these ballots. Although evidence of voter fraud is rare, Trump issued an executive order in March to restrict mail-in ballots nationwide, but a federal judge in Boston on June 25th blocked its implementation. Trump has continued to make false claims of widespread voting fraud in the 2020 presidential election that he lost to Democrat Joe Biden. During the first year of the COVID pandemic, the Republican-controlled Mississippi legislature in 2020 passed the law on mail-in voting on a bipartisan basis. The New Orleans-based 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in 2024 ruled in favor of the Republican challengers. It declared that the measure was preempted by federal laws setting Election Day for federal elections as the day by which ballots must be both cast by voters and received by state officials. The 5th Circuit did not immediately block Mississippi's procedures, but instead sent the case back to a trial judge for further review. The litigation was placed on hold pending the Supreme Court's consideration. During Supreme Court arguments in the case in March, some of the conservative justices expressed concerns that permissive mail-in ballot practices could cause the appearance of voter fraud. Some of the liberal justices said the arguments made by the challengers also would jeopardize the widespread practice of early voting prior to Election Day. Though the Fifth Circuit's action applied only in the three states where the regional federal appeals court has jurisdiction, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas, it called into question the voting practices in the other states with similar mail-in ballot policies. Other election-related decisions. Acting in other election-related cases, the Supreme Court's conservative majority in April gutted a key provision of the Voting Rights Act, blocking an electoral map that had given Louisiana a second black majority U.S. congressional district. The ruling makes it harder for minorities to challenge electoral maps as racially discriminatory under the 1965 Civil Rights Law and represented a victory for Louisiana Republicans and Trump's administration. That decision prompted several Republican-led states to pursue redrawn electoral maps ahead of the midterms in an effort to put at risk U.S. House seats considered safely Democratic-held. U.S. Supreme Court rebuffs Trump's appeal in E. Jean Carroll case. Washington. The U.S. Supreme Court declined on Monday to hear President Donald Trump's bid to overturn a $5 million verdict in favor of E. Jean Carroll in a case in which a jury found him liable for sexually abusing the former magazine columnist and then defaming her. The justices turned away Trump's appeal after a lower court upheld the 2023 jury verdict and rejected Trump's arguments that the trial was unfair because the judge impermissibly let jurors hear evidence of his alleged past sexual misconduct. Trump has been battling Carroll, a former advice columnist for Elle magazine, ever since she published an excerpt from her memoir in 2019 in which she alleged that Trump had raped her around 1996 in a Bergdorf Goodman department store dressing room in Manhattan. Trump denied Carroll's claims and asserted that she lied about the accusation, both in 2019 while he was still serving his first term as president and again in 2022 when he was out of office. Trump expressed disappointment in the Supreme Court's decision not to hear the appeal and called Carroll's lawsuit a fake case. "I will continue the fight against this weaponization and lawfare case against me, including the ridiculous claim of defamation, with all of my power and strength. This case is really against the United States of America and all it stands for, and should never be allowed to happen to another president or candidate-to-be," Trump wrote on social media. Roberta Kaplan, Carroll's attorney, said in a statement that the Supreme Court had affirmed once and for all the jury's unanimous verdict that Trump sexually assaulted and defamed Carroll. "His multiple efforts to appeal that verdict have all failed, and today's ruling ends his quest to avoid accountability for his actions," Kaplan said. Trump's Justice Department has launched a criminal investigation targeting Carroll, as it has against several other adversaries of the Republican president. The investigation disclosed in May was focused on whether Carroll committed perjury in testimony tied to the two civil lawsuits that she won against Trump. "Not my type." The case that led to the $5 million verdict concerned Trump's statements in 2022 when he called Carroll's claim a hoax and a con job in a post on social media. "This woman is not my type," Trump added in the post. Carroll sued Trump in federal court in Manhattan. Jurors in 2023 decided that Trump had sexually abused Carroll and defamed her, awarding $5 million in damages. They did not find that Trump raped Carroll, as she had claimed. The Manhattan-based Second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the verdict in 2024, ruling that evidence, including Trump bragging about his sexual prowess on an Access Hollywood video that surfaced during the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign, established a repeated idiosyncratic pattern of conduct consistent with Carroll's allegations. Trump's lawyers told the Supreme Court that the trial judge erroneously allowed testimony about multiple decades-old unverified and unrelated allegations to be presented to the jury, flouting federal rules governing the admission of evidence in a case. Carroll waited more than 20 years to falsely accuse Donald Trump, who she politically opposes, until after he became the 45th president, when she could maximize political injury to him and profit for herself, his lawyers wrote in a filing. The Second Circuit, in the other lawsuit Carroll won in 2025, declined to throw out an $83.3 million verdict reached by a jury in 2024 for defaming her when Trump first denied her claims in 2019 and asserted that she fabricated the accusations to sell her book. Israel-Lebanon deal may entrench stalemate rather than end war, analysts say. Beirut. A security deal between Israel and Lebanon risks entrenching a stalemate rather than resolving Israel's underlying conflict with Hezbollah by tying Israel's pullout from southern Lebanon to the Iran-aligned group disarmament, a condition regional analysts and politicians say is unattainable. At its core is a bargain few see as workable. Hezbollah has flatly rejected disarmament, and no Lebanese government has the power to enforce it. With Hezbollah unlikely to disarm, analysts say Israel has political cover to keep an open-ended military presence in southern Lebanon, which it invaded after Hezbollah fired at Israel on March 2nd in solidarity with Tehran over the war in Iran. The deal leaves the Lebanese state trapped between obligations it cannot meet and sovereignty it cannot fully reclaim, the analysts say. The framework deal also collides with Lebanon's political realities, asking a fragile sectarian state to confront the most powerful armed faction in the country, despite a post-Civil War system built on power sharing rather than coercion. This is not an agreement, it is an imposed settlement, said a senior Lebanese politician who declined to be named. The Lebanese army, he said, was neither structured nor equipped to disarm Hezbollah, and expecting it to do so ignored both the group's entrenched military capacity and the fragile sectarian balance on which Lebanon's stability rests. Burden placed on Lebanon. Political analysts say the imbalance is built into the agreement's design, with sweeping obligations placed on Lebanon, but no reciprocal guarantee of Israeli withdrawal. This agreement has put all the burden on Lebanon, said Michael Young, a Beirut-based analyst, adding that it creates a structure that allows the Israelis to remain in southern Lebanon indefinitely. Fawaz Gerges, a Lebanese scholar at the London School of Economics and Political Science, said the deal was born dead and is structurally flawed, hinging on a condition that is impossible to meet in practice. Gerges said Israel had already consolidated a buffer zone in southern Lebanon about 8 to 10 kilometers, 5 to 6 miles deep, while tying any future withdrawal to Hezbollah's disarmament. The terms of the deal risk the buffer zone becoming long-term and giving it diplomatic legitimacy, he said, describing it as a political gift to Israel. The conflict in Lebanon has been a central part of diplomacy towards ending the wider U.S.-Iran war. Gerges said Washington's deliberate decoupling of the conflicts gave Israel greater freedom of action in Lebanon. Fear of civil conflict. The framework agreement signed in Washington affirms that Israel has no claim to Lebanese territory and makes Lebanese army authority in the south contingent on the verified disarmament of non-state armed groups, including Hezbollah. Netanyahu portrays the deal as a historic achievement that could lead to broader peace, while Israeli troops remain deployed in so-called security zone, which Israel says is designed to protect its north from potential attack. We will continue to hold it, territory in the security zone, until Hezbollah and other terrorist organizations are disarmed, and until no further threat to Israel is posed from Lebanon, Netanyahu said on Saturday. Three senior Israeli officials said Israel has little faith in Lebanon's ability to disarm Hezbollah, but sees the deal as a vital diplomatic step toward building peace with Lebanon in the long run. About 4,000 people have been killed in Lebanon and 1 million displaced during Israel's military campaign against Hezbollah. Lebanese President Joseph Aoun welcomed the agreement as a first step towards restoring Lebanon's sovereignty, saying it should allow Lebanese people to return to fully liberated land. Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri said it amounted to an agreement of dictates, not one that preserves Lebanon's rights, and said it would not be implemented. Hezbollah chief Naim Qassem declared the deal null and void and a surrender, and said his group would keep fighting until Israel is forced to leave. Hezbollah lawmaker Hassan Fadallah warned of internal conflict in Lebanon. Any attempt to forcibly disarm Hezbollah would risk deepening sectarian tensions. Young said the deal won't lead us anywhere except to civil conflict and maybe an insurrection by the Shiite Muslim community. The deal's implementation in question. Danny Citronowitz, a regional analyst and former Israeli military intelligence officer, said Hezbollah's dismantlement was something that would never happen, and the deal, in effect, legitimized an open-ended Israeli military presence. Nothing will happen. Israel won't withdraw, and Hezbollah won't dismantle, he said. Citronowitz said no Israeli prime minister has the domestic political space to withdraw while Hezbollah is still armed and northern Israeli communities remain displaced. A narrower pact focused on Hezbollah's pullout from south of the Litani River, an expanded Lebanese army deployment, and an extension of state authority would have stood a better chance of success, he said. Pro-Hezbollah analyst Mohammed Obeid also said the deal was unlikely to be implemented, adding that its provisions were like explosives, capable of detonating Lebanon's internal stability as they hinge on state action to disarm Hezbollah. U.S. and Iran negotiators head to Doha, but meeting uncertain. By Andrew Mills, Parisa Havisa, and Bo Erickson. Doha, Dubai, and Washington. Iranian and U.S. negotiating teams were due in Doha this week, but Iran said on Monday no meeting had been scheduled as weekend missile fire from both sides tested the interim ceasefire to end the four-month-old war. U.S. President Donald Trump is sending his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and his envoy, Steve Witkoff, to lead the negotiating team, according to his press secretary, Caroline Leavitt, while Iran is sending its technical delegation to Qatar this week. Foreign Ministry spokesperson Ismail Baghe said this had no relation to the Americans' visit and no talks between the two sides were scheduled. We will not have any negotiating meetings at any level with the American side in the coming days, Baghe said. The disagreement over whether the sides would even meet underscored the fragility of a June 17 accord to pause a conflict that has disrupted global oil flows through the Strait of Hormuz and created a political headache for Trump ahead of November's congressional elections. The U.S. and Iran gave themselves at least 60 days to implement the 14-point Memorandum of Understanding to extend an April ceasefire, discuss Iran's nuclear program, and negotiate a permanent truce. But progress has been halting, with each side accusing the other of violating agreed terms. After the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran on February 28th, maritime traffic through the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow checkpoint that previously carried about a fifth of the global oil trade, came to a virtual standstill. Israel has not joined the U.S.-Iran peace talks and has distanced itself from the agreement. Tensions between Washington and Tehran have complicated efforts to end fighting in Lebanon, where Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri, an ally of Iran-backed Hezbollah, has cast doubt on a separate U.S.-brokered agreement between Lebanon and Israel aimed at halting the conflict. Closure of the waterway sent oil prices to above $100 a barrel, pushing up global inflation and putting pressure on Trump ahead of the midterm elections that will determine control of the U.S. Congress, where some of his fellow Republicans have criticized the president for waging war without lawmakers' authorization. A senior Iranian official said there would be a meeting in Doha on Tuesday. But unlike previous technical talks between Iran and U.S. teams in Switzerland, the focus would be on managing the Strait of Hormuz and de-escalating tensions. Another official with knowledge of the plan said technical teams from the U.S. and Iran are expected to meet separately with Qatari and Pakistani mediators on Wednesday. Uncertainty in Washington. Trump told reporters in the Oval Office, "The meeting in Doha is going to be perhaps important, perhaps not. We're going to find out." At the same time, he maintained, "We're winning militarily," and repeated his condition that Iran must be stopped from producing a nuclear weapon. Iran has sought leverage by flexing its control of the strait shared with neighboring Oman, saying it plans to charge fees to ships using the waterway and obstructing vessels that stray outside defined paths. The U.S. has accused Iran of hitting at least two commercial ships with missiles or drones in recent days and bombed Iranian military facilities in response. Iran, in turn, launched missiles and drones at U.S. military sites in Kuwait and Bahrain earlier on Sunday. Witkoff and Secretary of State Marco Rubio briefed members of Congress on Iran by phone on Monday. Republican Senator Steve Daines told reporters they kept their remarks to a minimum, but he nonetheless deemed the conversation constructive. Top Senate Democrat Chuck Schumer, however, called the briefing deficient and devoid of details. After dragging America into a costly war, the Trump administration still can't name a single thing Americans got in return. Instead, Secretary Rubio confirmed to me that Iran will reap billions in oil revenue while retaining dangerous leverage over the Strait of Hormuz, Schumer said. Release of frozen Iranian assets. Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian said on Monday that $5 billion out of $12 billion of assets frozen in Qatar would be released and returned to Iran, Iranian state media reported. He described the memorandum, which includes U.S. waivers for sanctions on Iran's oil and petrochemical sectors, as a great victory for the Iranian people. Oil prices rose more than 1% after weekend hostilities highlighted the fragility of the U.S.-Iran accord. French President Emmanuel Macron on Monday said he was working with Oman to de-escalate tensions and would cooperate with partners to demine the Strait of Hormuz. But Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister, Kazim Garababadi, responded with an ex post that the removal of mines was to be carried out solely by Iran, according to the 14-point plan. He warned France against complicating the situation. Oil stocks in U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve fall by 5.5 million to lowest since 1983. Houston, stocks of crude oil in the U.S. Strategic Petroleum Reserve fell by 5.5 million barrels to 325.7 million barrels, the lowest level since May 1983, according to data from the Department of Energy. The drawdowns are a part of a U.S. agreement to release 172 million barrels from the facility to plug a gap in global inventories after the Iran war and help push down fuel prices. U.S. crude stocks have rapidly declined in recent weeks due to strong export and refining demand for American oil. Since the war began at the end of February, overall U.S. inventories, including commercial and SPR stocks, have fallen by 111.4 million barrels to 743.3 million barrels as of June 19th, the lowest since 1984. Happy birthday, America. At 250, nation may be too divided to celebrate as one. By Tim Reed, Joseph Axe, and Hannah Bierer. Doylestown, Pennsylvania, Betsy Halsey, 63, still has memorabilia from America's 1976 bicentennial in her childhood bedroom at her parents' home. But the retired teacher is so appalled by President Donald Trump that she refuses to celebrate the country's 250th birthday. I don't want to be at the same party with people feeling enthusiastic about where our country is going, said Halsey, a frequent Democratic voter who lives in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Dan Marazzo, 70, a Republican and laundromat owner who lives in nearby Longhorn Manor, is ready to celebrate, believing America under Trump is thriving and will mark the occasion by cooking for friends and family. The poorest person in America has a better lifestyle than some of the richest people in the rest of the world, he said. As the U.S. prepares for its semi-quincentennial, the 250th anniversary of its July 4th, 1776 Declaration of Independence from Great Britain, political divisions that have defined the Trump era are testing what is traditionally a unifying summer ritual, celebrating the country's founding with fireworks, parades, and red and white bunting. With Trump stamping his imprint on the official commemoration, and with his second White House term marked by polarizing policies on immigration, the economy, and foreign affairs, many Americans are struggling with how to separate the politics from the pageantry. The very idea of celebrating has become political and partisan, said Beverly Gage, a Yale University historian. What is striking about our moment is how widespread the pessimism seems to be. One in five Americans say they won't celebrate Independence Day this year, including a quarter of Democrats and 8% of Republicans, according to a Reuters Ipsos poll. Two in five do not believe the country will survive another 250 years. To better understand how Americans feel about the anniversary, Reuters interviewed more than two dozen residents, activists, historians, and elected officials in Bucks County, where Halsey and Marazzo live. Once a political backwater, Bucks County today is a microcosm of the cultural and partisan schisms convulsing the U.S., a deeply divided region in a critical electoral swing state, Pennsylvania. It is a country Trump won. It's a county Trump won by fewer than 300 votes out of some 400,000 cast in 2024. Trump's imprint. Trump has put himself at the center of the country's birthday celebration. Last year, the White House created Freedom 250, a public-private partnership to organize anniversary events, despite the existence of America 250, a congressionally chartered commission that had spent years planning activities. Freedom 250's marquee event is the Great American State Fair, a two-week exposition on the National Mall. Trump held a campaign-style rally to kick off the fair and will deliver a second one on July 4th, drawing criticism that he is turning the nation's celebration into a political event. Several Democrat-led states and a number of musical acts refused to participate over concerns the fair was too closely tied to Trump. Meanwhile, the U.S. Mint is planning to issue a 250th commemorative gold coin bearing Trump's likeness. In Bucks County, Tabitha DelAngelo said she was so dismayed by the direction of the country under Trump that she did not plan on celebrating July 4th, something she would normally do. I love my country. I'm a proud American, the 56-year-old college professor and former Democratic school board member said. But this version of the celebration does not feel like it's about America, but instead a celebration of Trump. Among the county's quaint river towns, wooded enclaves, and farmland are some of the country's best-known Revolutionary War sites. But Bucks County has also been riven by unsubstantiated allegations of election fraud, fights over book bans, and protests over what version of American history should be taught in schools. In interviews, residents said the holiday, despite its traditional themes of national identity and shared history, had done little to diminish their concerns about local and national divides. Many were wrestling with questions that strike at the core of what it means to be an American. Are there still principles that unify the country? Or has a partisanship so fractured voters that they put party over patriotism? Jim Worthington, 69, a Trump supporter and health club owner, can't understand why anyone would sit out the 250th celebrations. He believes the longevity of America's existence is a marvel worth honoring, no matter who is president. This is a celebration of 250 years of history, the greatest experiment in the history of the world, Worthington said. Doylestown Councilman Connor O'Hanlon, 30, a Democrat, noted members of his generation have spent their entire adult lives in a hyper-partisan era marked by an overall nihilism and cynicism about the direction our country is going in. But he thinks Americans should use July 4th to reflect upon their shared beliefs, though some of his neighbors doubted many remain. Doreen Stratton, an activist and writer in Doylestown, can trace her family back to the Republic's earliest days. Her great-great-grandfather was among the few free black residents living in Philadelphia in 1776. Now she fears that years of progress, especially for black Americans, is stalling under the Trump administration, which has rolled back some civil rights protections for minorities. I almost look at it like I'm in mourning, she said, of the upcoming Independence Day. The divided sentiments have left local organizers of July 4th events facing a challenging task, how to mark the holiday without alienating swaths of residents. Derek Crater, whose nonprofit America Celebrates, is hosting celebrations in New Hope, Pennsylvania, and neighboring Lambertsville, New Jersey, said several people had sought reassurance the program would be nonpartisan. I think to let the celebration of our 250 go by without embracing it, regardless of your political stance, is a mistake, Crater said. How we tell histories. Historians note that prior milestone anniversaries also took place at tumultuous moments. In 1876, the country was coping with the fissures of the Civil War a decade earlier. In 1976, the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandal had shaken faith in government. One thing I'm very aware of is how poor people are at judging their own historical moment, said Yale's Gage. The story of some of the deepest moments of crisis in America were followed by the moments of deepest change. At Washington Crossing Historic Park in Bucks County, a stone tablet reminds visitors what occurred there in 1776 when George Washington led his troops through a Christmas night snowstorm across the Delaware River to launch a surprise attack on British Allied German soldiers in New Jersey, turning the tide of the war. Leading up to the 250th, the park conducted research on the contributions of women, black soldiers, and civilians to the war effort, in response to constituents' inquiries, said Jennifer Martin, executive director of the nonprofit that oversees the park. She emphasized their approach has always been apolitical. It's important that we are telling accurate stories, and they were not allowing the political climate to influence how we tell history, she said. John Godzibia, a retired police officer who has played Washington in Washington Crossing reenactments for more than 15 years, believes most Americans will embrace the moment, if only for a day. Maybe on July 5th they'll go back to being angry and disenchanted about the country, he said, but I think on July 4th they will be here. Survivors decry slow aid after deadly Venezuela quakes, by Mayela Armas and Vivian Sequeira. El Junquinto, Venezuela. Frustration rose across Venezuela over a lack of government help in areas struck by deadly twin earthquakes 5 days ago, with miracle rescues increasingly rare and the death toll hitting more than 1,700 on Monday. Among the casualties are believed to be as many as 140 people deported from the United States, including children who were staying at a hotel that was toppled Wednesday's back-to-back 7.2 and 7.5 magnitude quakes. On the fifth day of rescue efforts, the government tally showed nearly 200 buildings completely flattened and several hundred severely damaged. The rising toll of casualties, including 5,000 injured, was likely exacerbated by decades of neglect, poor building code enforcement, and shoddy licensing practices under past leaders Hugo Chavez and Nicolas Maduro, experts said. In El Junquito, a small mountain region about 20 miles west of Caracas, where Venezuelans often vacation on weekends, residents say they have seen few public officials, while farmers and other residents have been providing basic supplies to the community. We are waiting for answers, for debris to be cleaned up, for inspections, said Kylie Ibarra, a 33-year-old manicurist leading citizen complaints to authorities. She called on the government to do what needs to be done. El Junquito's commercial center was largely destroyed by the quakes, with collapsed buildings visible during a Reuters visit. Several residents with nowhere else to go have set up tents in an open field, despite the risk posed by damaged and collapsing buildings nearby. We don't know where we are going to be located or how long we are going to be here, said Tony Abreu, the owner of a local candy store who has been living in a tent since the quakes because his home and business are not safe. Signaling rising tension surrounding the politics of the recovery effort, opposition leader Maria Corina Machado said the Venezuelan government had blocked her entry from Panama, but resolved to find a way back to help the victims. Machado has been seen as a credible opponent to Maduro, but the Trump administration's ouster of Maduro in January led to his vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, taking power. With Washington's backing, Trump's administration has asked Machado to put her return on hold. At this moment, I'm willing to do whatever it takes, speak to whoever I need to speak to, in order to coordinate and save our people, Machado said in a video on X. Rising death toll, the international community has rallied to help Venezuela deal with the disaster, with most help focused in La Guaira, the hardest-hit state. Authorities said the oil-rich South American country has received support from 30 nations, including 1,000 metric tons of supplies, more than 3,600 rescue and support workers, as well as 118 search and rescue canines. It is unclear how many people are still trapped. Websites where citizens register missing loved ones show about 45,000 people unaccounted for. Jorge Rodriguez, the acting president's brother and president of the National Assembly, on Monday put the number of confirmed dead at 1,719, with 5,034 injured and 15,866 left homeless. Power outages on Monday have prevented a refinery, a petrochemical complex, and other industrial plants in the country's central region from restarting, industry sources said. Despite those issues, state-run oil company PDVSA was not expecting any domestic fuel shortages as output from refineries in the country's eastern and western regions is capable of meeting demand, even after increased usage by the rescue teams, they said. Oil output and exports remain normal, the sources said. Search for survivors amid aftershocks. Among the seeming miracles was the rescue of a 21-year-old Aaron Levy from a collapsed building in the disaster-stricken state of La Guaira, pulled out after 106 hours trapped under the rubble through a rescue operation that lasted 43 hours, according to Venezuela's interim president, Delcy Rodriguez. After announcing the updated death toll, Assembly President Rodriguez said 15 shelters had been set up in La Guaira, as well as 50 provisional camps to help people affected by the quakes. He applauded Venezuelans for their calm and strength, blaming any anger against the government on misinformation. Do not pay attention to rumors. Do not let yourselves be led by manipulation strategies on social networks or by media manipulation that seeks nothing due to increased unrest and anxiety. Rodriguez said, official information is the only one that truly has the truth to share with you. A senior U.S. administration official said 3 U.S. citizens are known to have died and 12 are missing since the earthquakes, and that a State Department task force has fielded more than 300 inquiries from Americans seeking advice. A second official said they estimate there are approximately 5,000 U.S. citizens in Venezuela. Italy and Balkans endure heat wave. U.S. also faces soaring temperatures, by Alexander Vasovic and Gavin Jones. Belgrade and Rome, Italy and the Balkans felt the impact on Monday of a record-breaking heat wave that has caused hundreds of excess deaths and disrupted daily life across the continent for more than a week, with growing concerns over the spread of wildfires. Across the Atlantic, the National Weather Service warned of dangerous heat with temperatures in the 90s and lower 100s degrees Fahrenheit across much of central and eastern U.S. in the days before the July 4 celebrations on Saturday, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The combination of prolonged daytime heating and limited nighttime relief will increase the risk of heat-related illnesses, especially for vulnerable populations and those without adequate cooling, the National Weather Service added. For Western Europe, where temperatures have dipped from record June highs, there was also a warning that the heat was likely to build again next week. In Italy, 22 cities from Bolzano in the north to Palermo on the southern island of Sicily were covered on Monday by a red heat warning. Pilgrims at the Vatican used fans to cool themselves and sheltered under umbrellas for shade as Pope Leo delivered his Angelus message from a balcony to the crowd below on the feast of Saints Peter and Paul, a holiday in the city of Rome. Wildfires in the Western Balkans. In Croatia, the Weather Service issued a red alert on Monday for regions including the capital Zagreb and the tourist destinations of Split and Dubrovnik. Dozens of firefighters, assisted by 4 aircraft, battled a wildfire burning pine forests on the tourist island of Vis in the Adriatic Sea, some 34 miles southwest of Split. In neighboring Serbia, the State Hydrometeorological Service has warned temperatures would reach 39 degrees Celsius, 102 degrees Fahrenheit on Monday. Further south, Albania contained a wildfire that has consumed many hectares of bush and olive trees near the southern village of Klos over the weekend. The heat wave, which began on June 20th, set records for early summer, and the blistering conditions disrupted power generation, damaged infrastructure, and overwhelmed healthcare systems. France has reported 1,000 excess deaths blamed on the heat wave. The French Public Health Agency said most of the heat-related fatalities involved older people and warned the number was expected to rise. French media reported that funeral homes in Paris and the surrounding area were overwhelmed by the number of bodies they had to deal with. The heat wave would have been virtually impossible without human-caused climate change, which has made this week's soaring nighttime temperatures 100 times more likely than they would have been just 2 decades ago, according to scientists. And that's all the time we have for today. Stay safe, and thank you for listening.